Okay, and this is, I'm in the home of Mike Moore in Kodiak, Alaska, for oral history of his experiences early in Alaska, growing up in a homestead over in the Anchorage area, and it's April 1st, 1993. And Mike, if you'd like to introduce yourself.
Yeah, I'm Mike Moore. I was born in Lansing, Michigan, 1941, and my family moved to Anchorage, Alaska in 1946. They sold everything they had in Michigan and moved to Alaska. In fact, they caught the last steamship to sail out of Seattle to Seward, and by train from Seward to Anchorage. My dad arrived at Anchorage with $120 in his pocket. He landed a job the first or second day in town with the police department, the Anchorage Police Department, of which the only train it ever had was the night watch. He was a policeman at night, and he was a flight instructor at Merrill Field during the day. And he had started flying all back in the mid-30s, and from Francis Aviation. In fact, one of the IFR simulators that you wear, goggles that you wear,
right.
The Francis ones, that's the guy that taught my dad how to fly. And they flew together for years. In fact, he came to Alaska numerous times. He had the Beechcraft, twin beaches. He'd bring his wife, and they'd come up, Jerry and Francis. And they'd fly up and go hunting with dad. Retained their friendship for years. I started flying at a real early age, although I never got my license. I bought a J3. I wanted to populate areas with different species that didn't have those species there. For instance, Cordova, lots of feed there, but no moose.
Right.
And so two springs, we weaned moose calves, and that's where they were taken. After we weaned them, they were flown to Cordova and turned loose. As we kept two of them out of all the years that we had the bears, the cubs, we picked out two of them and we had them for 12 years. And they were actually pets. They were the first bears in captivity that ever hibernated. And they were also the first bears back then that in captivity like that also had a baby. And there's a we've got pictures somewhere, I don't know where they're at, but of the sow for about 2 years with the kid. And of course, the big thrill in the summertime in the 50s was tourist buses. They discovered we had that animal. And so they'd come out with this busload of people. And I was a tour guide, little kid. And I got tipped. So worked out pretty good. I made a little bit of money. But we had a little log cabin that we built in 1952. We jacked it up, put a basement underneath it. And that's the year we had electricity and water finally. From 46 to 52, we hauled water and we used Coleman ladders with our light and oil stove for heat.
Is that place still standing?
Yeah, it's still there. Sits on top of a hill. So Lake Otis and Dowling, they homesteaded 40 acres there.
Yeah.
Dad built an airstrip there, which we flew in out of. That's 5 miles from the post office downtown in Anchorage.
Huh.
The
place has grown up a little since then.
Yeah.
When you got back into flying then in the 70s,
you said for a number of years you flew for the Iditarod, too.
Yes. For 7 years. I was flew the race marshal. Flew the race marshal for 4 years, and 3 years I was the chief pilot for Iditarod. I was also involved in the Iditarod for the 5 years that it went, and I was also the chief pilot for that. I also flew for Junior Iditarod. So I've got quite a bit of flying experience from Anchorage to Nome. And it's a lot different kind of flying. We've done a lot of search and rescue. I belong to an organization that was called Christian Pilots Association. And we did a lot of search and rescue. We had about a 50% find rate. And Silver Air Patrol and the Air Rescue Center in Anchorage would look. If they couldn't find them, people would contact us and we'd go out and see if we could find them.
And you're flying basically just a cub with a turn and bank indicator.
Yep.
And a compass, way
yeah.
compass.
Whiskey compass. I did put an ADF in later, and the ADF really works good. Flying interior, because the VORs, they're a line of sight, and you've got to get a lot of altitude before they work. As soon as you get behind any mountains or hills, forget it. Whereas the ADF will pretty much hold true. You can pick the radio station up or fly an NDB or whatever. Seems to work pretty good. My dad was also in the Silver Air Patrol for quite a few years. And during the earthquake in 64, oh, I forget how many hours, it was something like 150 hours of flying time he had in less than 1 month flying emergency supply and stuff to the communities in South Central. He flew for quite a few years for Silver Air Patrol. He was one of our Beaver pilots, and first came from the old school. And he started flying airplanes with big radio engines in and stuff. Mm-hmm. He got his license.
Was he a pilot? He was a pilot down in Michigan then.
Yes. Oh yeah. He used to fly old biplanes and stuff, where he got some of his flying time. Mm-hmm. His logbooks go up to about, I think, 3,000 hours, and he never carried out through. He just put right
yeah.
down.
Did he ever log your hours, or?
Yeah, I've logged. I've got about 2,500 hours logged, and I know I've got a lot more time than that. You never get. It seems like once you get over 1,000 hours, you just get real lax about filling out logbooks and stuff. But. And what a lot of my trips, like I did around, you're following a race, and you're going at the pace of the race, and you're going back and forth for a day or two around the same places. So it's kind of monotonous. So in some instances, what I did, I kept track of my total flying time. I just wrote down, I did around 120 hours flying time.
Right.
And most of the years I flew for them, it ranged anywhere from 60 hours to 120 hours. And of course, I did around, we flew dog food, people food, we flew the checkers, ham operators for all the checkpoints. I forget now exactly how many checkpoints there were, but there was a bunch. The only ones we didn't fly into, like McGrath, Munich, Leaf, and Nome. All the rest of them.
How many guys do they usually have flying for an Iditarod?
We had
those people you sign a permanent airplane to. Wherever they want to go.
Offset for the wind, set
yep.
course in their wet compass, and go right into it without being able to see much of anything.
Yep.
Hope they popped out.
Good reckoning. Well, it's, once you, if you do enough flying, and area. It's funny, you pull out a chart and even like crossing the huge valley on the Yukon River, from mountainside to mountainside of the Yukon River. That's a huge valley floor in there. And you'll be surprised, you get in bad weather and you're looking at your chart and you're looking at the course that you think that you're, and the course you want to be on, and you're looking for a little 200-foot hill.
Yeah.
And, yep, there it is. Yeah. You know, and you know you're on course then.
Yeah.
But there's a friend of mine crashed in the Alaska Range, and he survived 5 days. And he tried to go through a valley that was tremendous wind altitude. He went through it, the turbulence was so severe he throttled back. But once he got through this little saddle on the other side of the ridge, it was socked in. And he had to turn and go back out. But when he turned to downwind, didn't have enough airspeed going. And the plane just fell out of the sky and crashed in the side of the mountain. And no survival gear. He survived huddled in the wreckage with an engine cover and a catalytic heater. And the catalytic heater gave up on the fifth day, and that's was when we went up there. And there's a bunch of screw up there and we found him. And he's just getting ready to leave here. And he would have never made it.
Yeah.
He would have never made it to the civilization.
You know, you've been flying cloth airplanes too for
fabric.
Fabric. And how is that? How does that stuff handle in a real cold weather? Because I'm used to flying metal one.
It handles real good. A lot depends on what kind of paint you use.
Uh-huh.
If you use some of this acrylic stuff, you have to be real careful because it'll crack.
Uh-huh.
The paint will. Get what they call ringworm.
Right.
And, I've seen that. Yeah. And I've used a, I don't care for the dope, the grade A, and the dope that they've used on Cubs for years for the simple reason it fades.
Yeah.
I've got Dacron on mine, a real light, I think it's a 2 ounce Dacron. And I've used Stips for my paint. And I've never had any trouble with it. It doesn't crack. Ice comes off it real easy. It's fairly easy to patch and mend if you have to. The only problem that you have with a fabric airplane is you have to be extremely careful about, and that is the cold weather in the wintertime when it gets down to 40 below. If you don't have to fly, don't fly.
Yeah.
But if you do, you got to be extremely careful of turbulence. And you want to make sure you make soft landings. Because the metal, you know, we're talking chromoly tube. And then welded joints. And that stuff all becomes very brittle. I pull the gear fitting off, landing on the ice, pack out for a gnome. And I just hit a little pressure ridge. And the plane stalled out about 5 feet in the air. And I gave it a little bit of power, which wasn't enough. And if it had been for the pressure ridge, it would have been fine.
Yeah.
But the pressure ridge was coming down, I just checked the forward check cable, safety cable, just tore the gear fitting right out of the fuselage.
Yeah, that's not good.
No.
Now, this is the same company still that your dad's flying up there in Hagler today?
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
I bought it stock, and I've rebuilt it twice. The last time we rebuilt it was, the plane was tied up out of the Mallee, and the wind came in and tore it all up, so we had to rebuild it.
Yeah.
I completely rebuilt it ground up, even the wings, tore the wings all completely apart, started from scratch. It's a PA-12, which is that's what they call a super cruiser. It has the same basic wing design that a Cub has, although the stock PA-12 does not have flaps.
Okay.
But we've added flaps. In fact, this last rebuild, we went to huge flaps. We got 7.5 feet of flaps on the inside. And it stalls at 26 miles an hour. It cruises at 110, so in a lot of ways, it outperforms Supercuts. And empty, it gets off under 100 feet.
Yeah, that's pretty good. I guess, yeah, for the Iditarod and stuff, they slowed you down pretty good, like when we were hauling food and stuff.
Yeah, you, it was to each pilot, you know, that was one of the things I stressed with the pilots, is that you fly at your own ability and what you feel comfortable in doing.
Yeah.
And, you know, some guys didn't want to haul much in their plane, and that's fine. Another guy, you wanted to load it up good, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Really didn't matter. But we hauled, even dogs, drop dogs, those were the fun. Get a bunch of dogs, get about in a Cub now, which isn't a very big airplane. Get about 6 or 8 Huskies in the back end. And you get them in real fast, get the door shut, get the engine fired up, get airborne as fast as you can. And the takeoff, everything's fine, but once you get near, I've had this happen a couple times, so it'll get kind of, one of them will want to fight.
Yeah.
Or you'll have a bitch that's in heat.
Uh-huh.
And the males want to do their thing. And usually, just a real quick little forward push on a stick and right back, and it straightens them right out. They don't bother anything more.
Oh. Yeah, sometimes dogs and airplanes just don't mix.
Never had him go bathroom or throw up in the airplane.
That's good.
Did. That's good.
You know, I was thinking too, if you maybe a good time to think if you can remember any Bob Reeve story, or just if you know anything about him. You said your dad and he were friends back then.
Oh yeah, they were real good. They were real close friends. There's a lot of stories there. I went to one of his birthday parties. And I think the thing I remember about that was that they were the kids and the pilots who flew for Bob all got up and told stories. This was probably about 4 years, 5 years before he died. And that was at the Camp and Cook Hotel. And they were telling stories about Bob. And he bought his first DC-3 and went to pick it up, and when he pre-flighted it, didn't have any fuel caps on it. So they looked around the airport, and back then it was the, I believe, CAA. They found the CAA's DC-3 and they took the fuel caps off it. And adios down there.
Yeah, from what I'm just reading some of his books, he had a CAA, didn't see eye to eye all the time.
No. but you know, a lot of those pilots came to Alaska and they all gave something. And they all had to make a buck to survive. And so they came up with ingenious ways of doing things. And, you know, I know my dad, he hauled, for a while, he was hauling freight into some gold mine. And they'd load all you could get into this teak rate. It was overloaded. And you took off from Merrill Field, and you landed on this runway. It was a one-way shot, and there was no go-around, and so you had to be, and you had to land real hot, because you're overloaded and coming in at a real high altitude.
Yeah.
And, Bob, he was taken off from mud flats on skis and go out and land on glaciers. Another one that was a relation to Bob Reif was Don Sheldon. Sheldon found his little niche Mount McKinley. He was taking that cub of his and laying up there in the glaciers at 12,000 feet in the air. And when you think about it, landing in mountains, I've done some of it. Not that high, but I have done some of it on skis in the wintertime. And it's quite an exhilarating thing because it's not laying on a flat level, you're landing uphill. And what you do is you literally fly the airplane and keep it going. So you get up to the top and you gotta spin the airplane around and be headed downhill.
Yeah.
If you don't, you're in deep caca.
You're there for a while.
Because you gotta go up far enough to where you turn around and take off downhill. There's no way that you take off going uphill. And at the high altitudes like that, you get to use gravity to help you take off.
Sure.
Bob was a neat guy. He was a real personable person. As a kid, I can still remember. I went to school with Janice, who is now, I believe, the vice president. And then the one brother I knew, he was younger than us. He was behind us in school. But it was kind of neat looking back now. We were all kids. We went grade 1 through 12. Went to their house several times as a kid.
I just read a book about him, and he's just, some of the things he did are just fascinating. And, because he had a family to support. He had he came up there to fly to make a living.
Yeah.
That was his justification. Do you remember any other significant rescues you were in on in the Civil Air Patrol at all? The Civil Air Patrol has a pretty unique history up here.
Yeah, not the Civil Air Patrol, but I made two rescues. One was a lady that became the executive director later on for Iditarod. She was traveling with a film team on snow machines. We got this call that they needed a medevac, that they'd fallen in overflow, and she had overexerted herself, got soaking wet. She was suffering real severely with hypothermia.
Yeah.
And that's why they asked me and if I'd go retrieve her, and I said, sure. And so I threw the back seat out of the airplane, and I was on straight skis that year, and I flew out to the swamp, located them, and there was a little opening in there. Made a pass where it looked like I could get the cub in it and out with her. It was going to be real tight though. And so I landed, and they helped me taxi the plane in between the trees, and it was tight. And put her in the back end, and I poured the coals to it. And away we went. We cleared the trees by about 20 feet to the other end. And flew her into Lake Hood, and they had the ambulance there waiting, and they picked her up. And probably the one I remember the most, though, I think was the most gratifying, was Colonel Norman Vaught, an older guy that raced. And we've always been concerned about him because of his age, they thought fairly serious shape. His sled got completely demolished. He was in the burn area. I heard this over the radio, and nobody knew what to do. And the race officials they figured, well, we'll send snow machines out of Mykolaiv, and they can gather him up. Oh, well, shoot, that's going to take hours. So I was way down by past Ophir, and so I got my cub and headed for McGrath, landed at McGrath, told the kid to fuel the airplane up. I went in, found the race manager, and I said, what do you want to do about this Colonel Vaughn? He said, well, we're waiting for you to show up. He says, I said, well, you want to go for a ride? He said, sure. So he jumped in the plane, and away we went. And we found him, and there was a little lake. Well, let's rephrase that. There was a little, not a lake, there was a little swamp. And it had some ice on it. And the only way I got in there was I was on Snyder wheel ski. Wind was blowing real strong and steady. And, so I just made a real nice slow approach, brought her in, landed up, got on the brakes, pulsated the brakes, one brake, the other one, got the plane stopped, went over and checked him out, carried him over to the plane, got him in. I told the race manager, well, you wait here. I said, I know I can get the two of us. I can get Colonel Long and myself out. I took off, and the plane did so good, I just come right back around, landed, and got him and taxied back, and away we went. But he was really grateful. And another rescue that I did, there was a guy that lives up by Hayes River, was snowbound, and another guy, they had two dog teams. And I stopped the cabin and checked on him, and his wife said that he'd been gone for 2 or 3 days. She was real concerned because he didn't have any food. And he had been out of food. They didn't have any food. All he had was dog food. And so I landed, and the snow machines, they were trying to break trails, and they were probably 10 miles away. And so I took my survival gear out of the airplane, my survival food, and gave it to him. And I'll never forget it. Those two guys, I had these Newtone food bars where I stood in the airplane. They're kind of like a chocolate bar. And they looked like two kids eating their first chocolate bar. a real neat experience to help somebody out. And I used to do a lot of flying like that just to go up to people that lived out in the bush. Never got to go anywhere or see anybody. I take fresh vegetables, oranges, apples, stuff. I just fly up, spend a few hours with them, say hi. They really appreciated that.
Yeah, no, people appreciate that. It's fresh food and vegetables, especially in the winter time, are hard to get for and appreciate it. Hey, they go here to cook your off. I'm going to need another dog myself. Oh, let's see. Can you think of any other stories or anything about, you have any good bear experiences?
Bear experiences.
Growing up on the homestead?
Well, I didn't have any real fear of bears because we had these two pet ones, but the one I've got nipped and bit a few times.
Uh-huh.
The pet ones, they did. Want to get the frolic here, especially on creeks and stuff. And my dad used to take the sow down to the Campbell Creek, and she loved playing in the water. Mm-hmm. And people used to come down and they picnic. There was a nice little beach right there, Campbell Creek, with a sandbar. And my dad came out of the woods one day with her on a leash.
Oh,
and this lady looked up and says, oh, how cute. She said, did you just catch him? And Dad says, yep. And they, Steve McCutcheon was another lifelong Alaskan. He was throwing Max's photo.
Uh-huh.
And they used to, he was a photographer, professional photographer. And they used to get bear pictures in the wild of Sister E berries and or flowers and stuff, and it was quite neat on how they got to these spots because they have to take the bear naturally. Uh-huh. And what they used, Dad had an old 4x4 weapons carrier, uh-huh, and it had no top to it, yeah, just a windshield. And so what a lot of people saw was this old weapons carrier coming down the road with this bear, and they couldn't see my dad because the bear was standing behind with her paws up on the steering wheel. And my dad crashed down here trying to steer the truck.
Oh, man. That's... Well, you guys had mostly black bears over in that area then.
Yeah,
do you have any,
black
any,
bears.
Well, I guess what would they be? It's...
Do you like chili with beans or without beans?
Grizzlies. Yeah, grizzlies. Yeah, grizzly bears are... There's something else. I think they're more vicious than any of the other bears.
He's happy to see you.
Yeah. That's her buddy.
Yeah, she's a good puppy.
Yeah. Sick.
I haven't really ever had any real close calls with bears and hunting and stuff. My dad was a guide for 30 years, uh-huh, 40 years. And we used to have 15 horses. And I was always 2 weeks late for school because I was the wrangler. I had to go out with Dad and take care of the horses and help the hunter and all,
yeah,
all that. I think she was next door.
That sure beats packing it out.
Oh, yeah. We took up the governor of Vermont. Mortimer Proctor was his name. And he owned the Proctor Marble Mines
from Vermont. I've heard of that.
Yeah. He was a neat old guy. Anyway, he came up to get a moose and a sheep. And I spotted a goat. And he wound up and got that goat. And he was so tickled that he never figured he'd ever be able to get him out from him. That was a valid question. But the area that we hunted, when we first started hunting that area in the mid-50s, you could ride a horse up to these bowls, and there'd be big, beautiful rams all over, lots of them. And the area never was hunted that hard, and I think what happened was either the earthquake or a real bad winter kill, icy conditions or something, got to them. Or, unfortunately, the military and their,
yeah,
helicopters. So I've got a ram down my bedroom. It's about a full girl, a little better than a full girl. I got that when I was 15. And I got one that was bigger than that, but I gave the head away to somebody else. Shot lots and lots of moose. In fact, I was raised on moose meat. It took me a long time to get used to beef. In fact, I still rather eat moose meat. It's a real lean meat. Really good.
Were you affected by the earthquake at all up in Anchorage at that time?
Yeah. The fortunate or unfortunate, I was in the military. I was going through military police school, uh-huh, in Georgia, an earthquake hit. You know, the stories we got down there were pretty wild and woolly, and there was no communication. I didn't find out for a month what the status of my parents were.
Wow.
And I found out my sister sent me a telegram. She had got work from a pilot through a ham operator.
Yeah, it was an interesting era.
Yeah, it really was. You know, you couldn't walk anywhere in the 50s and early 60s. The first car by would stop and wouldn't take no for an answer. Take you wherever you wanted to go. Yeah. It was real neat, and it's kind of sad the way things are now. It's not a big city, and it's real sad, to me anyway. I enjoyed that small town. Everybody got along.
Anchorage has grown up to be quite the place since then.
Yeah. Well, I can remember when Anchorage ended at ninth. The park strip there, that was it.
Right.
And that park strip was the original airfield.
Uh-huh.
And planes used to fly in and out of it. Then they moved over to Merrill Field.
Right.
Then after Merrill Field, then they went to International Airport. Uh-huh. And built that up. I've flown with Reeve up the chain. I was on Amchitka Island in it was 69, I guess it was. And a guy driving a roller had fallen over and crushed a guy real bad. I was listening to the radio, and we said they'd land and pick him up. Mm-hmm. They had a GCA there. Mm-hmm. Visibility, when I say visibility was zero, I mean visibility was zero. And I parked alongside the edge of the runway and listened to the GCA guy talk to Reeve DC-6 in. I heard the plane. Never saw it. I heard it land. It taxied by me. I never saw it. I taxied over, picked the guy up, taxied back out, and took off. Well, that's the Reeve pilots were doing for that.
Mm-hmm.
So they were. You could say that they were the leaders in the first commercial bush pilots. They knew every rock out in that chain. And, you know, well, there's that rock. Okay, we can make a 90-degree turn here and stay 100 feet and make our let down 2 minutes.
He kind of got dislodged out of his, I guess, his stomping ground with Valdez and then Fairbanks. And kind of got, that was the last place left when the CAA started splitting stuff up.
Well, he was a big supporter of the military. And
right.
He actually trained a lot of the military pilots to fly on the chain and stuff. They came to him for advice.
Yeah.
And that's how he got involved.
Did your dad ever get into any of the military training, the military pilots at all?
No. He got them afterwards in Merrill Field. Mm-hmm. And he worked for Al Lindemuth. And under the GI Bill, there were. The GI Bill only paid enough money for 4.5 hours, and you had to give them solo for 4.5 hours. And they came up with a system to where they could solo a guy in 4 hours without any problem. And what it was, those first 3 hours of dual instruction, the only thing the student pilot had to do was hold the stick and work the rudders. The instructor worked the throttle. Yep. And that's how they do it.
I'll be darned. What kind of planes were they teaching them to fly in? Do you remember?
J-3s, T-crafts. Those were the basic planes. They're all tail drivers. That's you learn how to fly. There was a few Globe Swifts around them, and we used them for little advanced training.
Right.
The bulk of it was in the J-3s or PA-11s or Super Cubs or T-3s. T-Crate was a real good airplane for a student because the glide ratio or the angle for glides And the cheek rate was pretty level. That thing would go for miles. And the students had a little bit of problem landing them because they just didn't want to stop flying. And they were a good safer plane also. And they were side by side sitting on those.
Right.
So it was a little better for the student. Instead of having, you know, I learned in my cub.
Yeah.
And you got the instructor behind a cup in his hand and screaming, you know, behind you.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. It's by side. That's the way I learned how to fly. I was in a tandem seater, and I remember having something thrown at me one day.
Yeah.
So you can't really defend yourself from up.
No.
He's trying to think of something else. Do you remember any good stories from when you were learning to fly? How your dad taught you?
Well, probably my most memorable thing was on my solo cross country. Mm-hmm. I think I told that night. I had to fly from Anchorage to it's up by Glen Allen. Mm-hmm. And from Glen Allen to over the Parks Highway, over to Cantwell, and from Cantwell back to Anchorage. Mm-hmm. And of course, before I went, I had to check the weather, and I had to call my instructor. Mm-hmm. And he had called the weather, and it sounded like I'd have a nice, lovely, sunshiny trip. And so I started out, and I got to Glen Allen, and I went in the flight service. I didn't need fuel, but I went in the flight service and checked the weather. And he said, well, we got Cantwell's reporting. What they say, 1,000 feet of snow. Oh, well, so I decided to go ahead and go on.
Yeah.
And I got to the I forget the name of the road. It's a little road that goes back in there out of Cantwell, heading towards Glen Allen for a ways. And, I started hitting snow, picked that road up, and I had enough sense to follow the road, and the road would go there where I was headed. And boy, I got to Cantwell, it was really snowing. Landed, and I was supposed to get fuel there, and I got antsy. The guy never showed up, so I took off and headed down Broad Pass, headed for Talkeetna. And I started down there, and I thought, well, the sensible thing is to get over by the road in case something happens. So I did. I would go over the road. And I got down probably, got pretty close to Talkeetna, and we ran into snow chains and freezing rain. Windshield iced up, couldn't see out of it. So I decided the discretion was the better part of valor. I turned around and headed back Broad Pass. There's an airport there, just before you get to Cantwell or something. If they had a site there, with the NOAA weather station and all that. I made it back there, landed, hitchhiked home, and went back about a week later, the weather cleared, and I finished my solo cross country.
Yeah, that's, you live to talk about it, doing it that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Aviation up here is tricky.
Yeah. I met this one guy, we became friends, his name was Chip Morrow. He bought a mall down south, he learned how to fly. He had 250 hours probably, 300 maybe, and he decided to sell out, and moved to Alaska, and they were going to fly up in a new airplane with this M5 mall, and they're following the Alaska Highway. He made a wrong turn. I mean, there's not many turns on Alaska Highway, but he made the wrong turn. Kept going. Knew something was wrong, but kept flying. Pretty soon ran out of gas. He waited too long. And he wrecked the airplane. And landed. And, trying to get it down. Everybody got out of it unhurt. So. And you see a lot of that and young pilots with not too many hours.
Yeah.
You know, heading out, thinking they know what they're doing, and once they get committed to something, realize they made a real bad mistake, and just get completely terrorized.
Yeah.
And the pressure gets so great they cannot make a good logical decision.
Yeah. And, oh yeah, that's, things can get bad.
Yeah.
Have you ever done a lot of flying around the Kodiak area yet?
I brought my plane over one year and we flew quite a bit, and I've flown rallies. In fact, I got my float rating over here. I've been around the island, so I don't find it as interesting.
Yeah.
It's, I lived up there at Kinnick. Had the airplane sitting over in Wasilla. I'd load up the kids. This one here a little bit littler, but I'd load up the two boys and the girl and moms and our camping gear all in that PA-12. Cindy and Kyle, they were just little kids then. They'd ride in the baggage compartment on top of all this gear, and we'd go camping for the weekend. We'd fly over to some river and land on a sandbar and spend the weekend fishing and camping. Mm-hmm. So that you don't get here.
No, you don't. So,
and we had friends set up at Squintna, Hayes River, and we used to periodically jump in the airplane, go visit, spend the day with them or the weekend. Got to know a lot of people on the Yukon River and, well, all the way to Nome. A lot of neat people up there. And that's the only thing kind of sad about moving to Kodiak.
Uh-huh.
We lost touch with them. And they write every Christmas, "Gee, when are you going to stop by and see us?" Joe Delia, he's another old Alaskan. He lives up there. He's the postmaster up there at Squintna. And there's been articles in the newspaper, and there's somebody probably writing a book about him. But he's an old trapper, trapped up there for 40-some years. And he had a cute story. You know, trappers have an area that they trap in. And another trapper will not move in and trap in that trapper's area. It's just a code of ethics, if you will.
Right.
Well, some young whippersnapper from Wasilla or somewhere decided he was going trapping. So he moved into Delia's area. And Joe was a little upset at first, but then he got to looking at the guy's sets and he saw the humor in it. So he went back home and he went back out and got a couple bags full of hot dog buns. Because what the guy was doing, he was taking a hot dog and putting it on a stick. And the guy knew actually nothing about trapping. Joe went back through with buns on all these hot dogs. And the guy laughed. He pulled his gear and laughed.
That's a good one. Oh, man. Yeah, I can see how you'd miss it up there. I kind of like, Kodiak's a neat place, but I used to do a lot of flying down in Southeast, and I think Southeast would be a neat place to own a plane and, do just that thing, fly up in some of the islands there, and Chichagof and Baranof, there's a couple dozen or two valleys that you can land on sandbars, run around the salmon runs that are great.
I remember as a young pilot, all these neat things that Chris can do. I remember the first time I wanted to go to a place they called Poly Creek, go clam digging. And I asked this guy, where's Poly Creek at? And he said, he says, "You can't miss it. It's big minus tide this weekend." He said, "Just fly down the right side until you see a whole bunch of airplanes." And he says, "That's it." Well, that cover got 4.5 hours of fuel on board. And, you know, he gets flying for about an hour, and, you know, he's, you know, maybe I look blurry.
I think for what, an hour and a half?
And he followed all the way down there, beach all the way, and beach. And pretty soon there's this big hill coming, rock cliff, and there's no more beach, you think, you know.
Yeah.
And I remember what that guy said. And I went over that ridge, and the other side, boy, was he right. There was planes everywhere. There was twin otters, beavers, and they're all just landing out there on those flats out there. Tiger's out, and that sand just instantly turns hard enough that it'll support any twin airplane.
Now, this is down in Cook Inlet?
Yeah, down in the lower part of Cook Inlet. Okay. And next to, just where you get to Skunk Harbor.
Uh-huh, okay.
And, guy, we had a ball, but they've had a couple of fatalities now. So many planes taking off, and nobody watching, and everybody excited. And, gee, you go down there, and what I do, I take these 5-gallon pails, and snap lids on them, and I get some salt water in, and shoot, you didn't have to walk in, you just landed the plane, pick a spot, land, and get out, and right there, boy, you can fill a bucket up. In 15 minutes.
These razor clams?
Razor clams. And you put them in that water, now by the time you get to Anchorage, all but the bottom layer is all cleaned out, all the sand's out.
That's right.
And gee, we built a fire up on the beach there. Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
That makes me hungry. I haven't had razor clams for years.
And then we used to fly to Cusatan. And we had places we'd go at certain times of the year. In July, what was it, honey, the 20th of July?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, around we'd go to Cusatan, and there was an old dirt strip, and it was a sand strip, and the only planes that could work it were tail draggers, and they had to be cups. So it eliminated a lot of people. It was a long strip, but it had these big holes in it. And you had to pick up, it had to be a good pilot, and you had to pick up, and you had to land in these big holes.
Right.
And we set our tent up, and there was a sow and two cubs. They're usually around there, but they never bothered us.
Yeah.
One night they started to, kind of. Mama got a little scared. But we called it, you know, there got to be so many people learning how to fly stuff on the radio. When you talk about these places, you didn't call them by their name. Mm-hmm. And the Cusatan River, to all of us that went down there, was called the Plum 40. Mm-hmm. And the Plum 40 means a plum full of fish, and it was 40 minutes flying back to Anchorage.
That's good.
The Plum 40.
I met, Von Mitten. He's a dentist. And he was a fairly new pilot. And there was a little creek that in April and May was some of the best rainbow fishing you could ever imagine. And it was a little creek called the Ivan River, and it was just past the Big Sioux. And the when the oil companies, when they were doing their seismic testing, they had built this little road. It is just barely a one-lane road. And every so often they'd put a lick of gravel for a turnaround for the dump trucks.
Right.
But it was very narrow. And they built it out across the swamp that paralleled this Iron River, right where the best fishing was. And so what you do is you go down this little road, and you get your plane off, and go hike over, and get your limit of rainbow. And, you know, and we just got our limit where I heard a plane come in, and wind was blowing across them. And I never give any thought. Pretty soon, we started walking out. Pretty soon, we met this guy and two other people. And he introduced himself. And my name's Von Mitten. I'm Mike Moore. He says, you own the airplane up there? And when he said that, I thought, oh no, this guy smashed into my airplane. I said, yeah. He said, well, could I get a ride back to town? for you. I'm like, well, you just landed, didn't you? He says, well, yeah, sort of. And he quit flying the airplane as soon as the wheels touched, and the wind just carried him right on off the road and in the swamp. Flipped over backwards. And so I flew to Anchorage, left him there. I flew to Anchorage and got a guy by the name of Bob Merlin, who's a mechanic. Tell him what happened. He grabbed some pieces of lift strut and a pop rivet tool and a few hand tools and a cordless drill. Flew him back here, and took us about an hour and a half. And we had the airplane ready to fly. The prop was bent, the windshield was split, was busted. All four of the lift struts were buckled. And so what we did, we dug a big hole in the swamp for the nose and tilted the plane up, got it up, stand up vertically and stopped it there. And straightened the lift struts, and the pieces of lift strut that we brought that were split, we put those over and pop rubbed them. And then carried on over, we laced the windshield, took a rope and some sticks and straightened the prop, and towed her back up onto the road, fired her up, and flew her back to Anchorage.
Yeah, that's amazing itself, the way some of these guys can get planes out of some of these awful places. I mean,
yeah.
I'd have to walk away from some of these that I've seen, but they get them out.
Yep. It's just totally amazing.
Oh, it is. Well, listen, I'll let you get back with your family here, and I appreciate you. I mean, I've got some great stories here. In fact, I might come back after you for more of these sometime. I want to get over to the Civil Air Patrol. I'm really, I had done that down in Sitka for a couple of years, and then I let it go. And coming back up here and getting into getting over to the Aero Club on base has spurred my interest again, because it's a good organization.
We, another, just one last thing I just have to think of. I got to fly illegally an air show back in 48,
uh-huh.
It was 48 Merrill Field. They had an air show that was a real 1930 style air show.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things, they did, they had a bunch of pilots in their planes. They're all lined up. And you had to undress and down to your skivvies, or you had bathing trunks.
Right.
And as soon as you got your bathing trunk, you could run to your airplane, take off, and you had to come around. You had to make a spot landing on a certain spot.
Uh-huh.
And then you had to change clothes again. And I mean, stuff like that. I got to fly in the baggage compartment on that.
That's interesting.
And they had flower bombing, and we dropped a little bag of flour,
trying
to hit a spot. April, Kyle, get your dog.
I think I'm asking for it. Go on, get down. Ah.
I went to Gulcana. That's the name of it, Gulcana. And the first year they had a same type of deal there, and I entered the competition. It was kind of neat. It was kind of tailored after they had a 2-day thing.
Uh-huh.
1 day was competition. Anybody could enter, and it cost like $5 to enter. You could enter any competition you wanted.
Right.
And then the second day was acrobatics. Mm-hmm. Regular, they had static air show. They had the A-10s. They brought A-10 Warhawks down from Hileson or wherever. They had biplanes and doing all their stuff in the second day. But the first day was real neat because you had bush pilots. Guys have been flying Alaska for 20 years, bringing their Cubs down and doing short field takeoffs and short field landings. And I didn't do too bad. The first year I took first place in short field landings.
That's good.
And the next year, I think it was 2 years later, I went, and I was going for short field takeoff.
Uh-huh.
That's what I was going to try and place first in.
Now, is this with the big black guns? No,
it had flats, but not the big ones. And in fact, the announcer, both years I went, the guy remembered me the 2 years before, because he called it Mike's helicopter. Because when I rotated and that plane went in the air, I stood it right on its tail and it just right straight up. And they couldn't believe it. In fact, the third year I went, FAA got a little upset. They said, no more hot dogging.
Yeah.
But I pumped the tires up real. The first year, I knew I couldn't beat these Cubs off because they're too light. But the third year, I had a brand new engine, I had a 160 Lyco. And I figured I could get them. And so I pumped I had these 30-inch air streaks, so I pumped them up real hard. So no friction, just.
They
still beat me. They got a better gust of wind than I got. And I took second place that year. There was a lot of exciting moments. There was a 206. There was a 206 that the guy tried to hammer it off. He hammered it a little bit too hard. And we're talking about pulling back and hit the tail.
Yeah.
Bouncing in the air, a 206.
Uh-huh.
And he jammed the cone and got the rudder locked. The rudder wouldn't work.
That's not good. I know a guy had his elevator cable snap on a float plane. Actually, Washington came in and he did one hell of a job. I mean,
that's where it's real important to have your plane properly rigged.
Yeah,
that was a lot of fun because everybody camped. There was no place to stay, so you took your tent up there. And they had a lot of parking there. You just pull your plane, find a spot, tie your plane up, pitch your tent right alongside your airplane. And it was a ball. We had more fun. And the wind was always good. We always had wind. And it was a Mother's Day is when they had it.
Do they still do it up there?
Yep. The last I knew, they were still doing it.
That'd be interesting to go through something. That's a check in on that.
But it was exciting. And it was. FA ruined it a little bit. They came in and were doing a lot of tire kicking. They were writing pilots up for illegal tires. Everybody was having a lot of fun until they showed up. It was kind of sad that they did. And nobody was getting hurt. Everybody was just having a good time. And the guy that owns and builds Arctic Terns, that's the Super Cub, Bobby Beal, I think his name. Okay. He showed up with a brand new Arctic Tern, and they had a grudge competition, short field takeoff against a Cub, a Super Cub. And he said he made a statement he could beat any Super Cub off. And the Cub beat him off just barely. But the amazing thing that this guy did.
So with part two here.
So they took off down the runway. The Super Cub just barely beat him off by, I don't know, 10 or 15 feet maybe. Beal got his already turning the air. And went right up. Dropped the nose just for a few seconds. And he couldn't have been more than 300, 400 feet above runway and did a loop.
Wow. Now, there was no FAA guy around then.
That was the first year, the third year I went. But it was really, now they had another deal similar to that they did down in Clam Gulch, taking off, short field takeoffs and landings. But this one at Gulcana, April, get down. It was just a real neat deal. A lot of fun.
I'd like to go to something like that just to see the guys come in, just to see the planes that come in.
Yeah. Well, the Thompson brothers, they built their own, what they called a Cubby. Yeah, and they built an airplane that was fashioned after a Super Cub. Mm-hmm. But you look at it real close and it's a lot different. It's got Fowler flaps. and it really didn't do all that they had anticipated. There were a lot of airplanes that could be there.
Yeah.
I've got a friend of mine that's an A&I that built up a copy. He ordered an airframe and did all the rest of it himself. He's got a pretty weak for it. I think it's a 180. But he sent the engine outside and had a blueprint. So it's putting out about 230 horsepower. And it's awesome. And a friend of mine, Danny Davidson, one of the pilots I flew with for years, Danny took the Super Cub up and flew it for the guy up at Gulcana to first place. But they had short field takeoffs and short field landing. Then they had power off spot landings.
Right.
Then they had flower bombing. What else did they have, honey? I never did be good ATOL flower bombing. What I should have done was just let Chris throw a pitch at what she thought it was right. It's just like the time on Disky, we had a call for Tang. They were out of Tang at this checkpoint. Mm-hmm. And we had these cases of these little personal containers. You stick the straw in?
Yeah, yeah.
It's all pre-mixed. Well, I said, oh, no problem, I'll just airdrop it to them. And those wolves who sit in the river, it's a pretty narrow little river. In fact, there's probably... Huh? Yeah. Yeah. And the cub just will squeak in there. You gotta be careful if there's a tree leaning, you gotta go underneath it, you know. But anyway, I made this low pass. There was a snowdrift. I was going to try and have these tank things going there. They were in a case.
Right.
Going to snowdrift. And, you know, and I told Chris, now! And once she pushed them out, timer, I pulled them up on a stick, and I looked back, and all I could see was this big yellow area coming out like that. It hit the side. Solid ice and broke before it was over half up, just exploded.
That stuff, there's a knack to dropping things from the air like that.
Yeah. And there's a rule that I always had, and I didn't do it once, I almost got killed. And that is, if you do airdrops, you're going to have two people. The pilot flies the plane, and you have the other person drop the item. And one, they needed a saw at that same checkpoint. They didn't have a saw left. And I carried a little emergency saw with me. So I got in the air, I reached underneath and got my saw out, my survival gear. I opened, I got a seaplane door, I opened the side up.
Right.
And it takes two hands. One to stick, one to throttle, right? Well, you gotta do this to throw the item out. I threw the item on it. I must have done this because I kicked the rudder and I was headed right for the trees. I just rolled it right up, was like that. And it was close. It was too close for comfort.
Yeah.
And so I almost, I broke one of my rules.
You guys going to move back up there when you're down here in
Cody?
You're working for electric
company. Yeah, KEA. Well, that's debatable. Maybe soon. We miss Anchorage and also Connecticut. I was hoping that we can last it out here for at least 10 years. What's that, honey?
I wouldn't like it here if you tried it. But you wouldn't like it here if you tried it. Well, that I know, because that's where we want to. I'm getting ready to do that. There are a couple places where we're going to. Kodiak's a neat place to visit.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't mind coming over here for a visit. I look down and I'm sick of the mosquitoes, and I really like that part. That's one island I prefer.
Yeah.
If that's the
world. I don't know what we're going to do. I'm getting...